Once more under the breach, dear friends. Else closes up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff McClure. Jake is doing the opposite of what he normally does when he disappears off of the radio program. He is, instead of in the Caribbean sailing or something similar, he's up in Alberta, Canada, which, in my opinion at least, says something about his sanity. It's really, really cold up there, and he chose to go up there. It's amazing what love will do to a person. It's an in-law sort of deal with wives and wife and things of that nature. Anyway, Jake isn't here today, and I am, and that means that I'm going to be by myself talking to this green foam ball for the next 2 hours unless you give me some help. Telephone numbers in here if you'd like to call in with questions, comments, or conversation about anything to do with things of a economic nature. The telephone numbers are 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. Again, the telephone numbers here at KTEM, 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. Anywhere else in the United States. And, of course, good luck if you're outside of the United States and you're wanting to make a call. The telephone number is 254-773-1400 with a little one in front of it, which indicates you're calling into the United States. So, it's cold outside, and today is November 15th, and I need to give a short disclosure here. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio presentation. Jake doesn't like me to call it a show, which makes sense. A radio program. It is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas, known as the Personal Wealth Coach. And that's not coincidentally. That's not coincidental. I'm getting my tang tangled up today. I don't think I got 8 hours sleep last night. Don't feel like I got enough sleep. So it's one of those things where I feel a little behind the power curve, particularly without the without the young Baldy sitting across from me. So, what happened during the week? Well, more of the same. The week here ending on November 15th, we saw oil prices fall and the S&P 500 rise. For the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up just a tiny bit, 0.35%. The S&P 500 up 0.39%, for the week. For the year, year-to-date, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 6.38. The S&P 500 up about 10.36. The relationship 1 year on. This is one of those interesting times, despite all the great fluctuations. I should say great. The significant fluctuations, one we had back in October and one earlier in the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 10.48% for 12 months, 52 weeks. And that is very, very close to its extremely long-term average. So, oddly enough, despite the fact that things don't quite feel normal yet, this last year has been, the last 12 months have been abject normality. S&P 500 is up 13.44% for 52 weeks. Again, something that is pretty close to its normal rise over an extremely long period of time. Now, one of the differences is that average inflation over the time period that we're measuring here, which is runs out to about 100 years, has been about 3%. And the inflation in the last year has been about 1.7. What that means is that both the Dow and the S&P 500 in real terms have done better than normal during the last year. And that's a little hard for a lot of people to swallow, a little hard for people to stomach, because we look at who's in the White House. And if you're in Bell County or Williamson County and you're listening to this, you probably are unhappy with who's in the White House. And we look at the fact that that the market is doing better than average. Now, it's one of those things that I want to go back and remind you of, This is an I told you so. When President Obama was elected, I said at the time, and it is certainly proven to be extremely true, that stock markets do much better. The stock markets in the United States have much greater gains when there's a Democrat in the White House. Now, why? I frankly don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But when we see something that is so consistent over time as this is, and this is extremely consistent to the point of absurdity, when Republicans are in the White House, the market tends to do poorly. Your personal wealth in your retirement account tends to do poorly. And then when a Democrat goes into the White House, sometimes there's a little dip at the front end. But by the time that Democrat leaves the White House, the market is so dramatically improved that everybody's well-being is financial, who's an investor, is far, far, far better than when the Democrat was elected. And then, of course, those same people who tend to do very, very well in the market are the people who often promote the election of a Republican, which causes their portfolios to fall. And that is one of those irrationalities, weirdnesses that make up the life of the stock market. And it's one of those things that we watch a lot. It's kind of like Ed in the previous show was talking about a lot of the intricacies of winning football games and when you do and when you don't and when offense and when defense and getting to bowls. There's a lot of arcanery that has to do with that. And in this particular case, there's a lot of arcanery that has to do with the markets. And it gives us a lot of, those of us who do this professionally and who try to plan, to use George W. Bush's term, strategery around the market to have some idea where we need to be positioned financially, where we need to be positioned as far as investments are concerned, to do well going forward. One of the things that we recognize is that when a Democrat is elected, if you're not fully invested, you probably ought to get fully invested. And if a Republican is elected, you probably ought to back off. And that runs directly counter to intuition, but that's the nature of markets. So what else is happening in the world? Well, probably one of the more significant things continues to happen. And again, this week ending November 15th is one of those weeks where we've seen more and more of the same thing that we've been seeing in the past, recent past at least. The European economy continues to teeter along on the verge of trouble. The price of oil continues to fall. The Russian ruble fell about 25%. And the dollar continues to strengthen in the world. There's a tremendous trend going on in the world, and it seems to be intensifying. The European Union announced what has happened. The GDP for the third quarter in the European Union grew 0.2%. So it's still below where it was in 2008. In other words, while the United States GDP is now significantly, the gross domestic product, the total production of the United States is now very significantly above where it was in at the top of our productivity and production in 2007 and 2008, the European Union remains below by about 2%, by about where it was before it entered the downturn that is sometimes known as the Great Recession. Is that significant? Yeah, it is. Why is it significant? Because it provides a model for how things work. I don't know how many are listening. I don't know if anybody's listening. But if you listen to us during this recovery from the recession, we've noted again and again that there are three great experiments going on in the world. one experiment, three different versions actually going on in the world. The Europeans, again, counterintuitively, focused tightly, led by Germany, focused very, very tightly on austerity. Cut government spending, cut deficits, cut spending in general. We may need to bail out critical elements from time to time, the equivalent of bailing out a state that was about to go bankrupt. But we really need to cut spending. We need to cut our debts. We need to be very fiscally conservative because we've had this crisis. The end result is that Europe, by my definition, by Jeff's definition, is still in recession. And Jeff's definition, by the way, of recession is the period between the peaks. In other words, I look at a recession as a valley. The official economic definition is during the recession is the period when economic activity continues to slow. So when it hits bottom, the recession is over. I look at it, the term depression, for example, which is a more severe term than depression, than recession rather. A depression is an area in the ground that is lower than the surrounding area. And a valley is an area that is lower than the two sides. And you're not out of the valley until you get back up to the same elevation that you were before you started into it. So I tend to look at recessions, depressions, from the perspective of peak to peak. It's a valley. And it's not just the down and the up. In that case, Europe is still in a recession. And why are they in a recession? There's a consensus among anyone who studied this right now, and I have not read a single person. Of all the analysts and economists who've looked at this, who have concluded that the smart thing to do when we enter a recession now, they were saying things like this, but saying that we really need to cut spending and cut employment and have the government laying people off and avoiding going into debt when we're experiencing a recession. That's in the United States. In Europe, they did that. The Germans, who are terrified of inflation natively because they still have this deep-rooted social memory of the 1920s going into the 30s, and they wound up electing Hitler because of this, of this terrible inflation that scarred them horribly. And that horrific inflation, they're so afraid of that event that happened a long time ago that they have produced, as they have led Europe, because the Germans very definitely are the leading economic power in Europe, they have led Europe into a period of austerity. And in that period of austerity, the economy of the European zone has not recovered back to where it was in 2007. So now they have been 14, 15 years in the pits. A lot of argument could be made as to whether we've completely recovered in all aspects of what we're doing. And that argument basically would hold water anytime that we have a change. We have relatively high unemployment in the upper 5% range. That's not high historically, and is certainly nothing compared with what goes on in Europe. But it is higher than we're used to. We like to see around 4%. Unfortunately, that's not going to change anytime soon. It's going to be very, very difficult to get more people employed in the United States for a very simple reason. Now, let me caveat that by saying as new people come into the workforce with appropriate training, they're getting hired very quickly. We're hiring a couple of 100,000 people a month, seasonally adjusted. And in fact, if you take out the seasonal adjustment, we're hiring millions of people this time of year. So we're moving along fairly nicely, and we kind of occupied the middle ground. And the middle ground in this particular case was we did some significant stimulus in the economy led by the Federal Reserve, although we also had federal stimulus programs, which were fiscal from the federal government. We ran up some big deficits, spent a lot of money, and we are recovering very nicely. Speaking of deficits, our current federal deficit is down to 2.8% of the gross domestic product, and that's below the actual growth in the economy. And as a result, for example, government expenditures in the last fiscal year, which ended October 1st, September, it ended at the end of September, technically. During that fiscal year, government expenditures rose 1%, but government revenues rose 9%. That combination is something that will eventually, if it's left alone and if it's managed correctly, gradually dig us out of the debt level that we have now, which is the highest real debt the United States government has experienced since the 1950s. It isn't the record debt by any stretch of the imagination. On several occasions in our history, we've had a much larger debt in terms of gross domestic product. But we are, in effect, paying down the debt right now because inflation is running about the same or less than the actual gross domestic product, not the net. So the end result is that we are the healthy economy of the world. Our economy is growing year over year at about 2.3%. There's a consensus among the better economists that we'll see about a 3% growth in the economy next year. Now, I want you to compare that to the European growth. Now, it was over the quarter, they grew 0.2%. Which means that there, if you annualize that, it is somewhere well below 1% a year for an annualized basis. And in fact, that's about, it's actually grown less than 1% in the last 12 months. Oddly enough, Greece, and you think this is, I think, you got to admit that this is to some degree funny. The Greek economy is the fastest growing in Europe right now at an annual pace of 1.7%. Now, if we had a 1.7% GDP growth in the United States, we would be quite afraid and quite concerned. The Europeans are very, very proud of the fact that we're seeing some growth in Greece finally, and which I think is a plus. It's good to find that the sick guy is getting better. But the bottom line to this is that the European experiment, which, by the way, many of the more conservative, at least commentators in the United States, insisted that that was the way we should go in the United States. We should avoid debt. We should cut spending, which is kind of an intuitive way to approach it when times get hard. The fact is, though, at the national level, if we do that, we tend to put our economy in deep trouble. Now, let me give you another example. The Europeans are talking about, at least the European Central Bank, is talking seriously about what we refer to as quantitative easing, QE, which is where the central bank actually goes into the market and buys bonds. There's a lot of people against it, and it's questionable whether the Central Bank of Europe has the authority to do that. A lot of people are challenging it and will challenge it if they do it. And in Japan, which has suffered through a long, long, long recession, the government pretty much has a lot of control over the central bank, and the central bank has now gone full blast into quantitative easing, purchasing of bonds, to try to put money back into the economy, to stimulate the economy, and get them out of their interminable deflation. And it's really a drag in Japan. And then when we move over to China, we find that although the Chinese are certainly not in a recession, they can't afford to be in a recession, they are manipulating things as fast as they can because they're in a bit of a crisis. Now, their bit of a crisis is a little different from ours. The size of their nation and the degree to which people have an expectation of coming out of the poverty in which most of China still exists is so high that they need to have about a 7% growth a year just to do the equivalent of breaking even. And they're right at that. They're just above. It looks like their gross domestic product growth right now is right at just over 7%. Anything below 7% growth in China is the equivalent of a recession. And the reason I say that is the number of people entering their workforce each year and the number of people who are continually shifting from job to job in migrant worker conditions need a 7% growth rate, or you will have literally millions of people, back that up, hundreds of millions of people, out of work and very, very unhappy. And this is a country that does not have unemployment insurance. It does not have Social Security. It does not have Medicare. And if you don't like those, that's fine. But the point is that without those, it doesn't have a cushion. The end result is you will have people literally starving to death. And that's not conducive to a stable government. So the Chinese will do whatever is necessary, including spending a lot of dollars to employ people, to keep unemployment very, very low in China. And they will just stimulate the heck out of the country whenever they feel like they need to. Their stimulus plan was huge in comparison with ours. And they did not experience a great recession. They did wind up building several major cities that nobody lives in, which we think is silly, but it kept people employed and it kept them from starving. What has that got to do with us? Well, basically what the end result of this experiment appears to be at this point is that we pretty much got it right. We could have improved on it by probably putting a little more stimulus in. Now, the backside to that is, during good times, during times when the economy is booming, it's probably a good idea to pay down the debt. And let me give you a little bit of history. In other words, our overall total national debt, which is about 70-some percent of our gross domestic product, upper 70s, is too high to sustain for a long period of time. Now, the good news is, among the developed nations on the planet, ours is the lowest as far as our major sustained economic entities on the planet, which means mainly the European Union. That's our number one competitor in that area. Great Britain is another one out there. But we have the lowest percentage of gross domestic product when we measure our actual debt held by the public. Now, when we look at that and we see the debt held by the public and we see that it's up around between 77 and 79%, depending on who you read and how you want to analyze this, that is a little too high. And the reason it's too high is we have a problem coming down the road. The problem is that a lot of people are going to retire in the next 10 years. A lot of people are going to retire in the next 10 years. A lot of people are going to hit their Social Security retirement age, and they're probably going to live a lot longer than the actuaries had originally assumed. So we have the potential here in the United States for elder care in its various forms and formats to cripple our nation. And this would be a good time to start looking at it. And, of course, nobody is paying any attention to it at all, at least publicly, because they're terrified of it in Washington. They're terrified of it because the older people can be easily riled up to vote against any party that tries to fix a broken system. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be fixed. It needs to be fixed. It desperately needs to be fixed. By the way, the last time we fixed it, which kept it alive, and means the only reason we have it today is because the Greenspan Commission, headed by that redoubtable Alan Greenspan before he was chairman of the Federal Reserve, proposed to Congress, and Congress passed a bill, and the president signed a bill that extended the full retirement age, the age at which a person could draw full Social Security without having huge cuts in Social Security for working, from 65 to 67. And very frankly, now it needs to go up to 70. The liberals don't like that because they say, well, the poor people won't live that long. And the poorer people tend to be in worse health at that age and they can't work. And there's a host of reasons behind that. And to which when somebody, and I have had some interesting discussions with some people about that. The point is that when Social Security was enacted, it was assumed that the vast majority of people wouldn't be alive to draw it because they had a short enough life expectancy. If we assume that everybody is going to draw Social Security, the whole population will live to draw Social Security, for example, for 10 years, we would need to at least double the Social Security tax and the Medicare tax from the current 15%, roughly 15% of wages, to 30, which would be devastating. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I read in the Dallas Morning News that Richard Fisher is going to be retiring, I think, in February of next year. How is a replacement assigned or voted on, and is he going to be or is she going to be as aggressive as he is? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. That's a good question. Richard Fisher, for those of you who don't know, is the chairman of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank, or the president, I'm sorry, of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. And as it sounds, he gets that position is filled by elections, and those elections are by the members of the Dallas district, which includes all of Texas and spills over into some other areas, and the members are the banks. So the banks get a vote according to how big the bank is, and they elect a president. That sounds actually fairly simple, and that's the way it works. And then that person goes into a rotation to be a member, a voting member, or an observing member of the Federal Open Market Committee, which is the one we hear about when we say the Federal Reserve raised rates or the Federal Reserve did this or the Federal Reserve did that. It's actually the Open Market Committee that does or doesn't do these things. And the reason it's called the Open Market Committee is because the Open Market Committee buys bonds sometimes on the open market, which is what they've just done. We called it quantitative easement. And they also set the interest rate the Federal Reserve charges banks to borrow money directly from the Federal Reserve, which sets this baseline for all such borrowing. Now, Mr. Fisher in the Dallas Fed has been known to be a hawk, and a hawk is one who fears inflation greatly. He's one of two or three hawks on the Federal Reserve Board that recently, the last several years, have insisted that the Federal Reserve start cranking interest rates up again. Two of them are retiring. That will only leave one hawk left on there. And we're pretty confident. There's a pretty high level of confidence that whoever replaces him will not be a hawk. And the reason I say that, it's not particularly popular with the banks right now that the in the Dallas district or any other district for the Federal Reserve to start charging them more money. They are not real interested in that for a host of reasons. Of course, their bottom line is something they're always concerned about, but they're also concerned about the economic health of the nation because their activities are related to it. But they've pretty much across the board concluded that inflation is not a threat at this point. What's a threat is deflation. And for whatever it's worth, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, in the opinion section, that said, who's afraid of a little inflation? And Lynn Woolley was kind enough to send it to me, although I did run across it on my own. And there's a really interesting conundrum here. Conservatives, by and large, think deflation is a good thing. But they haven't thought about it very much, or they wouldn't think it was a good thing. Deflation is when prices drop, and the article suggested in the Wall Street Journal, the opinion article, that a 2% drop per year in prices over a long period of time would be a really, really good thing for the United States. Well, I'm going to disagree with that rather directly and pointedly, Because I can tell you that deflation, unlike low deflation, unlike low inflation, doesn't stay low historically. It jumps upward dramatically, and it does so in a hurry. And there's a reason for that. A lot of companies have a very thin profit margin. 2% profit margin is actually in the vicinity of the total profit margin at Amazon. And particularly in the environment we have today, where you have a lot of high volume, low margin sales going on, if prices were to fall 2% a year, it would cause a really, really large number of bankruptcies in the United States unless, I mean, I'm talking about in very, very large companies, unless those companies took some dramatic actions to lower their internal expenses. Their largest internal expense, almost without exception, is going to be employment. So in a 2% price decline environment where we had 2% deflation per year, companies are going to be laying off significant numbers of people. That's a given. The second thing that's a given is they're going to be lowering prices because that's what deflation is. And they have to lower prices in order to get people to buy things. And that, by the way, is going on right now. My wife was, we got our, we had about a 40% reduction in the cost of electricity in our house because she worked out a deal with TXU where they are charging her about 7.4 cents per kilowatt hour for the next 6 months, and then she gets to go back and negotiate it again. We were paying somewhere between 11 and 14, so we got a really good cut in the cost of a commodity. Now, this is the interesting thing. There's been no loss of value of that commodity, electricity. In other words, the electricity is the 1 kilowatt hour of electricity does exactly what 1 kilowatt hour did the other day. But we're paying 40% less for it. That's deflation. And if you go to Amazon or you go to any place that you want to go, there is already a creeping expectation that somewhere in the future, something that you want to purchase will be offered at a lower price. That's what Black Friday, by the way, is all about, the day after Thanksgiving, because there is the expectation that stores will cut prices at that point. And that's the day when we have a tremendous surge in retail activity. We've had some relatively mediocre to anemic growth in personal spending. We've seen a significant increase in personal savings over the last year. This is an indication that we have incipient deflation going on in the country because in an inflationary environment, people tend not to save but rather to spend. In a deflationary environment, people tend to save rather than spend. And why? In a deflationary environment, every year you hold a dollar, let's say we had a 2% deflationary environment, the one that was mentioned in the article in the Wall Street Journal, then a person would have, by holding a dollar in your hand for a year, first off, your hands would get really sweaty, but if you have a dollar and you put it in a lockbox someplace in your house, in a safe, it's worth 2% more in buying power a year later, 4%, a little over 4% after that, a little over 6% in 3 years. In other words, you'd be about 6% because of compounding. You'd be about 6.5% in 3 years. Now think about the fact, where can you find a 3-year CD that will increase the value of your what you put in the bank by 3.5% or by 6.5% in 3 years? And you can't find it. And even if you could find a certificate of deposit that paid 2% a year, completely liquid, you could pull the money out anytime you want to without any threat of surrender charges or penalties for early withdrawal or anything else. I want you to think about this. If you could get 2% a year tax-free on savings that are completely safe and completely liquid, people would flock to it. And so what happens in a deflationary environment is people sense that, we being economic beings and the average person really is pretty smart with their money when taken collectively. And so what happens is people then start to hoard money. They start to retain their savings in boxes and in safes. Now, you think, well, okay, saving more money is a good thing. Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't, because this is the point. They're not spending the money. And because they're not spending the money, people start getting laid off. And stores start decreasing prices. They start lowering prices so that people will come and buy things. And then people buy things for a little bit. But the other thing they do is they defer purchases waiting for lower prices. So you have this tremendous slowdown that goes on in an economy that's subject to deflation. It's going on in Europe right now. It went on in Japan for many, many years. And it's still going on in Japan. And they're trying to shock the economy out of it right now. So what happens in this deflationary environment is you get falling prices, people getting laid off. Now, why do they get laid off rather than just cut their pay? Because businesses don't like to cut pay. People get really, really angry if you cut their pay. So what businesses do is they lay off people, wait just a little bit, and then hire somebody at a lower price. Lower wages. And when they do that, it causes a drop in the standard of living in the nation. And that drop continues. And their profits start to fall, which causes the stock market to go down, which means retirees have less money, which means they spend less money. You see this cycle that starts to build at this point. Meanwhile, we have unemployment insurance, we have Social Security, and we have Medicare, and those are there. And I don't hear anybody saying, even among the most conservatives, that we should get rid of that very, very socialist program called Social Security, in which people who are working pay people who are not working. Or we should get rid of Medicare, because prior to Medicare, once you hit about 65 years of age, you just basically couldn't get medical insurance. And if you got sick, you went broke or died, or both. So nobody is suggesting we get rid of either of those, but those are fixed costs. And in a falling dollar environment where you have deflation going on, the dollar's worth more every day. Deflation. Two big things occur. All the fixed dollar items rise in cost. That's the biggie. And the fixed dollar items include things like your mortgage and what you owe on car payments. In a deflationary environment, those items rise in cost. And they take more and more and more of your income if your income is falling. And believe me, during deflation, a lot of retirees would see their income fall simply because they have a 401k or they have an IRA or something, and they're using that as a supplement to their Social Security. And as it goes down, they're either going to decrease their spending or they're going to go broke. And this sounds like a nightmare that I'm describing of deflation. It is a nightmare of deflation. And Europe is on the verge of entering, the European zone is on the verge of entering that nightmare. And we are teetering on the edge of it, which is why it's very, very important right now that the Federal Reserve not raise rates prematurely, not try to fend off inflation that isn't there. And by the way, the surest sign of inflation is rising wages at the low end of the scale. In other words, when we see the blue-collar laborer wages go up dramatically, month after month after month, we have inflation. And that occurs when we have a lot of people employed and we have more jobs than we have people. And the bidding starts on trying to keep people in their jobs. That starts to run the cost of employment up. We're paying people more and more to do the same work. We are paying, and pretty quickly, in order to finance that, businesses start raising the price. So instead of the cost of electricity for our house going down 40%, it would start going up each year because all of the producers would start raising the price associated with supplying 1 kilowatt hour of electricity. Well, that's a long, long monologue on my end. It's time to do some commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and I can't, not worth wealth couch. My tang is tangled up today. And my name is Jeff McClure. Telephone numbers to call in here on the other side of commercials are 773-1400 or 1-866-597-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake, being out of town, has gone up to Alberta to experience really cold weather, which means when he gets back here, he'll appreciate whatever it is we're having. By the way, I was curious about this, so I did some research as to why we're having this sudden blast of cold weather and what the polar vortex is all about. And it was really kind of, and I would encourage you to not just believe what I have to say about it, but to go out and research it if you question this. And it turns out that the reason we're having this unusually cold weather in this particular time of year, and we had it last year, is because it's too warm in the Arctic. I know that sounds strange, but apparently Alaska, by and large, is warmer than Wisconsin right now, which is, to say the least, unusual. The what it boils down to is there's a lot of water exposed in the Arctic region that historically was not exposed. I mean, during my lifetime, I've watched during the latter part of the summer and as we go into fall, flying across the North Atlantic, I've noticed that when I was in my 20s, even in late summer, it was pretty much solid ice up there within the Great Circle route from Newfoundland over to Europe. And now it's mostly water. Well, it takes a while for that stuff to freeze again up there in the winter. And during that time period, the water is giving off, is much warmer and absorbs sunlight. Of course, the sun's getting lower and lower, but the water warms up pretty nicely, relatively speaking, up there, which warms the atmosphere and puts a lot of moisture into it. Historically, the atmosphere in the polar regions this time of year is extremely cold and extremely dry. Well, what that has done is that at that relatively moist, warm atmosphere pushes the cold air that is normally found over the land masses just south of the poles, it's normally across the entire polar region, literally starts to slide down and shoves the cold air further south, which is why we get these outbreaks of extremely cold winter, is because basically the polar ice is melting, and each year there's a little less of it than there was the year before. So for a while we're going to get this. Now eventually, that'll probably shift around and we'll have warm winters, but the situation is a real oddity. Global warming is causing us to have unusually cold winters down here, which sounds really strange until you realize that they're having unusually warm winters in Alaska. And that what happens is air displaces other air, and right over the mainland in northern Canada and so on, the air gets quite cold, but instead of staying up there and joining with the air over the poles, it gets forced out and gets shoved down in our direction. And that also should be accompanied by record snowfalls, which is, by the way, how the Earth typically cools itself off after a while. You get a lot of snow covering northern Europe, northern Asia, northern North America, as more and more water is exposed for longer and longer periods of time over the Arctic region, because the globe is warming up. It gives off more moisture, and in the wintertime you get heavier snows over the northern Arctic regions, and the heavier snows gradually build up over a period of time and eventually become glaciers, and eventually everything starts to migrate south. What happens is the warmth comes up from the equator and the cold comes down from the north, and so we get some pretty big extremes. So, oddly enough, and the paper I read summarized all the other studies, in essence said We will have colder winters and hotter summers as a result of overall global warming, which is sort of an interesting thing. By the way, anyone who hears global warming and thinks that I am being some kind of left-wing fanatic or something, I know it's now called climate change. All I have to say is that if you question global warming, all you have to do is go to Colorado, as I have for many, many years. My wife and I got engaged up in Estes Park, Colorado, and we know in August what the Front Range up there used to look like. It used to be a lot of white along the top of it. Now there's tiny little patches of white along the top of it, and even those in some years pretty much disappear. The same is true across the board. And again, if you fly across the North Atlantic and you say there's no global warming, all I've got to say is if you fly from, in late summer, if you fly from the United States to Europe, you'll look down at blue water. And 40 years ago, when I would fly across that same area in late summer, it was solid ice. So something happens. When the ice melts in your refrigerator, when the frozen food thaws in your refrigerator, in your freezer, you can fairly well be assured that your freezer has gotten warmer. And that's just the reality of what's going on in the world. How much we're affecting it, I don't know. I do know there's a lot more carbon dioxide in the air now at high altitudes than there was 20 and 40 years ago. And if that means we're generating more carbon dioxide in this planet than the plants can soak up, which would tend to be the case, then perhaps we ought to cut back on our carbon dioxide emissions. This has nothing to do with a liberal or a conservative agenda. It just has to do with the reality of I don't breathe carbon dioxide real well. Anyway, that's where we are. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. My name is Jeff McClure, and the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or 866-597-1400. We're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour. I say we, me, myself, and I. Jake is out of town. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, if you'd like to contact the Personal Wealth Coach and tell us things you want us to say or not say or talk about or not talk about, or you just want to talk about investments in general, locally, our telephone number, we have voicemail during the weekend, 947-1111. And if you're outside of the local area, you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 800-914-7526. It's 800-914-PLAN. You're welcome to email me at jeff@tpwc.com. You're certainly welcome to go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and listen to podcasts.